Good morning and welcome to our podcast. I'm David Pritchard, Head of Marketing here at Sintons, joined by two of my colleagues this morning who are consultant Elizabeth Gallagher from the family team here at Sintons, and also welcoming Adam Hutton, who is an associate in our dispute resolution team here at Sintons. And you'll have heard a lot from us this week. Sintons is once again lending its support to Resolutions Awareness Week, which this year highlights the need for cohabitation reform. We've had and continue to have a lot of content going out this week, articles, podcasts, blogs, Q&As, all of which you can find on our website. I'll tell you about the details at the end of the podcast. Podcast today will last approximately 10 to 15 minutes, and Elizabeth and Adam are going to discuss marriage, cohabitation, and the differences between them. So I'm going to pass you straight over to Liz. Liz, good morning, and over to you.
Good morning, David. Thank you very much. So yeah, we're going to be talking about cohabitation and marriage and the difference between them. This has all been prompted really by Resolution, who is an organisation of family justice professionals who are campaigning to raise awareness about the difference between marriage and cohabiting couples. And they're working to take steps to try and give cohabiting couples at least basic rights on relationship breakdown in the same way that married couples have. Interestingly, a recent survey indicated that almost 50% of British adults don't understand that cohabiting couples have fewer rights than a couple who are married or in a civil partnership. So sort of in a nutshell, there's no such thing as a common law wife or husband. So here at Sintons, we thought it would be helpful to explain some of the differences between the legal position of a married couple as opposed to a cohabiting couple. Just to set out a little bit of boring theory initially, I would mention that the law that's applied to married couples, we look to what's called the Matrimonial Causes Act. It's quite an old act, 1973, but we're stuck with it for the time being. And maybe that's going to be another campaign of resolution in the future. But at the moment, we rely on that act. And that act is largely governed by a set of rules called the Family Procedure Rules. If, however, a couple aren't married, they don't come under the jurisdiction of the Matrimonial Causes Act. And we have to look at property law. And that is governed by a different set of rules known as the Civil Procedure Rules. Now, family lawyers tend to just deal with the Matrimonial Causes Act and the Family Procedure Rules. So it's helpful for us if we have any tricky issues to seek help from our colleagues who are more familiar and used to dealing with the Civil Procedure Rules. So as David said, to help me explain the difference between these two statutes and the rules that govern them, I'm joined today by my colleague Adam Hutton from Sintons Dispute Resolution Team.
Thank you, Liz. Yes, I think as you rightly raise, it's an important misconception that people think there's a common law marriage, and often couples that cohabiting may fall foul of that. So to highlight the difference for resolution as part of an awareness campaign is hugely beneficial.
Thank you. So what we thought we'd do is maybe just run through a couple of examples and just try and highlight the different ways or the different outcomes for the couple, depending on whether the couple are married or they're just living together. So my first example, I'm going to call them the Smiths. We've got Mr. and Mrs. Smith, and we're going to assume that they've been married 15 years and they've got two children who are aged 10 and 8. So Mr. Smith purchased a property around 2005. He then met Mrs. Smith in 2006, and a year later, she moved into the property in 2007. So by that time, Mrs. Smith had this property for a couple of years. A year later, they got married in 2008, and then the first child was born in 2013. Now, at the time, Mrs. Smith had some debt, so it was unlikely she was going to be able to get her name on the mortgage, and I guess they were probably busy getting on with their lives and having the children. And so the legal title to the family home was left in the name of Mr. Smith. It was never transferred into joint names. Sadly, some 15 years after they were married, their marriage broke down and they came to look at how they were going to resolve the financial issues at that time. So in terms of what would be in the pot to be divided between them, we'd have the full value of the house. At the time that they separated, it was valued at about 500,000 and had a mortgage of 100,000. So we would say the equity, the value that in the property was 400,000. Mrs. Smith hadn't earned very much because she stayed at home and spent more time looking after the children, whereas Mr. Smith's career had taken off and he'd managed to get various bonuses through work and had accrued some savings, but he'd put those savings into his own name. And he had about £100,000 of savings when the marriage came to an end. And he also had a pension with about £400,000 in it. Now, because Mr. and Mrs. Smith were married, all those assets can go into the matrimonial pot and consideration can be given as to how they should be divided between the parties. And in a court situation, the court has various powers as to what to do with the assets. So they can order a transfer or a sale of the property. They could order a lump sum to be paid. They can order maintenance to be paid for either spouse, and they can make an order to share pensions. The considerations that the court will take into account to do that, there's a list of considerations, and that gets us back to the Matrimonial Causes Act, Section 25, that there is a list and judges have a wide discretion as to how to apply the factors in the list. The overriding consideration has to be the welfare of any children. We then tend to focus on the income and earning capacity of both parties and the needs and obligations of both parties. And then there are other things such as the standard of living, how old the parties are, how long they've been married, contributions that they've potentially made to the marriage, conduct only in very exceptional circumstances, and benefits that will be lost by not being married, such as pension benefits. So we sort of have to throw all those factors into a melting pot and apply them to that particular case and come up with a satisfactory result. Now, obviously, the property is only in the name of Mrs. Smith, but she's got rights under the Matrimonial Causes Act. We look at those factors, what her needs are, and her primary need is she needs a house to live in and she'll need some finance. So potentially she could be ordered a significant sum to be able to be rehoused. In every situation, we have to look to see if there can be a financial clean break between the parties so that one person isn't financially maintaining the other one. There can never be a clean break as far as children are concerned, but in an ideal world, it's good if there can be a clean break between spouses. Now, if Mr. Smith is earning more than Mrs. Smith, one way that a clean break might be achieved could be potentially to give her a greater share of the equity. So if she needed, for example, £300,000 to buy another property, which would be about 60%, I think, of the equity, the court could potentially order that. And if that would mean that she could potentially have a clean break, you know, she's had that bought a clean break by having a little bit more equity, that might be a way forward. She potentially will want some security in a pension. She can have a pension sharing order. So there's all those tools in the toolbox of the court, bearing in mind the overriding consideration for the children. As I said, there can never be a clean break in respect of children. And in terms of financial support for the children, the parties could agree that, or if there was a dispute, it would be assessed by the Child Maintenance Service, which is probably one issue that is similar to a cohabiting couple. But you will see that there are lots of options open, and Mrs. Smith, you know, hopefully her needs will be looked after moving forward. But if Mr. and Mrs. Smith weren't married, the position would be quite different, I think, Adam, wouldn't they?
Yes, that's correct, Liz. I mean, essentially, the only concern when we're looking at it through a civil lens and the civil matters here is really the property as such, not the other elements that are considered under the Matrimonial Causes Act. So, for example, if the parties break, what Mrs. Smith is going to have to be concerned with is, on the face of it, she is not on the title of the property, so not a legal owner, and she is also not on the mortgage, which suggests that she doesn't have a beneficial interest in the property. The way that this is governed is through the Trust of Land and Appointment of Trustees Act, commonly referred to as TLATA, and that gives the right of anyone who thinks they have a beneficial interest in the property to make an application for a declaration as to the extent of what that beneficial interest should be. So in this situation, it probably fall upon Mrs. Smith to look towards making that application. She would have the burden of a proof of establishing that she had a beneficial interest in the absence of the legal interest. But that is the matter which she would have to go down to establish that she had that interest in the property.
And would that be quite difficult for her to prove?
So starting position is generally that equity equity follows the law. So when looking at the legal ownership, so you're looking at the title of the property, here we have a situation where it's just Mr. Smith. But often there could be reasons for that. In this situation, there are some scenario, there are some suggestions as to the reason behind that being some potential debt that Mrs. Smith had to prevent her getting to getting a mortgage. And those are things that can be considered. Sometimes the parties will discuss this and they will decide what the interest is in between each party, whether that's equally or otherwise. But if that's not the case, then it will be for Mrs. Smith to try to establish that A, she has a beneficial interest, and B, the extent of that beneficial interest. In this situation, it's the scenario calls it a family home. So that's something that would potentially aid her. A family home is considered to be shared. But ultimately, in the absence of any sort of express agreement, the evidence would have to be what the intentions were of the parties and whether a common intention constructive trust can be established. If there are certain factors such as children that do feed into Tolata applications, but mainly it's about the children and the welfare and the making sure that they have a home. That's usually if there's an order for sale, for example.
But I think really what we're saying is that for Mrs. Smith, if she's not married, she's going to be in a lot weaker position than had she been married. And I think just because she lives in a property with a partner and they've got children and they pool their financial resources, it doesn't mean to say that she's automatically going to have an interest in that property.
Yeah, that's right. That automatic sort of entitlement that you would get potentially from being married doesn't apply in this situation. And it could be a situation like this that leaves one party a significantly disadvantaged after many years of potentially cohabiting.
I mean, there is another statute that potentially Mrs. Smith might be able to make a claim under, and that's what we would call Schedule 1 of the Children Act. And in those kind of applications, and I have to say they tend to be fairly high net worth claims, it's where the sort of financially better off party will sometimes buy a property for the other party to allow the other party and the children to live in the property, but that property is just held on trust. And once the children are 18, that trust will come to an end and the party who's living there then has to find somewhere else to live. But that is one way of trying to get a housing need for a person who's cohabited. But as I say, there has to be sufficient funds to be able to do that, so that they're quite unusual applications. And so I think we'll probably touch on at the end a little bit of advice as to what to do if you're in Mrs. Smith's position of not having your name on the title and not being married. So if we just move on to the second example, which I've just called the Browns, and we assume a similar scenario, except when Mrs. Brown moves into the property with Mr. Brown, she insists on the property being transferred into their sole names. Saying in my example that Mrs. Brown then becomes ill, she's unable to work, the marriage breaks down, and she says she wants to stay in the family home, which has been adapted for her needs, and she just wants Mr. Brown to keep his savings and for her to keep the family home. From a matrimonial point of view, we're back to Section 25 of the Matrimonial Causes Act. We have to look at those factors as to whether that would be possible. But the crux of the matter is that the court can adjust the party's entitlement to the property. Even though it's in joint names, it doesn't necessarily mean it's automatically equal. So there is a chance that potentially the court might say, depending on the circumstances, that yes, the property could be transferred to Mrs. Brown. Mr. Brown keeps his savings and that's it. But again, Adam, if we've got a property in joint names, parties aren't married, the relationship breaks down, what's the likely outcome in that situation?
If they're holding the property in joint names, then you're on a much better start, because with the same principle of equity follows the law, legally you're both on the title to the property, and therefore it's up to the presumption that it's owned jointly and equally to be rebutted. It depends also whether or not there is a declaration of trust that the parties have entered into. This is something that's not always obvious from the outset, but if parties can enter into a declaration of trust, which states, for example, what their relevant percentage equity of the property would be, and if that was something that they entered into, then it's unlikely that that's going to be changed, apart from a few very nuanced ways in which that can happen. So starting off at the position as being joint owners, what would have to happen is that under Tolata, one of the parties could make an application for a declaration seeking their extent of the of their percentage of the share of the property. Now, often there isn't really documentary evidence absent of a declaration of trust to show this. So often you're relying upon the conversations which the parties have had and trying to ensure what the common intention was. And the court can infer what that was through the course of dealings of the parties. Or if it's not possible to infer, but there is an agreement that there is a beneficial interest in a situation where there's joint owners, that'd be fine. Then they can impute that, that decision. The considerations here are going to be the whole course of dealings between the parties, the why it was put into joint names in the first place, the contributions that, that people have made throughout towards the mortgage, living expenses, improvements to the property and otherwise. But it, each case is judged on a case-by-case basis. You'd need to know exactly what the situation is between the parties and what it is that they were looking for and their intentions were in order to try to establish if there is a difference to what would seem on the face of it, a 50-50 joint ownership.
And if there isn't very much evidence or nothing can be produced significantly, is the starting point, or you would assume that the parties have intended it the to be split equally between them?
Well, it depends on each case. In this scenario, you have the situation where they're both joint owners and joint names, but it doesn't look like she's contributed from the example to the initial deposit to the property. We'd have to work out whether or not she contributed to the mortgage, but in respect of it, another expenses for the houses to do so. But what she would really need to do is in order to solve that is, as I say, to make the application under Tolata. If we take a situation where they're not disputing that they own the property on a 50-50 basis as equal owners, then you can actually use the act to just make an application for an order for sale. And that would potentially be to realise your equity in the property. So the property is sold and the profits in that situation would be split 50-50, for example.
But in this scenario, Mrs. Brown's saying that she's ill, she can't work, her needs are great, she really wants to stay in the property. She can't use those kind of arguments.
Not in the same way, because it's looked at more in terms of the ownership of the property and what the property rights are, yeah, rather than anything else.
Yeah. So we're looking at strict property law rather than these factors that the court can take into account if the parties are married, really. So if she just sits tight in the property, Mr. Brown would have to make an application to court to...
That's right. If they couldn't come to an agreement between them and she refused to leave the property, then he would have to make an application under Tolata for either a declaration and or an order for sale if that was what was decided.
And what would happen, say, partway through the proceedings, Mrs. Brown's family said they could lend us some money to buy Mr. Brown's share of the equity? Because obviously under the Matrimonial Causes Act, that's something the court can order, transfer of property. I don't think that's the same in a Tolata case, is that right?
No, that's correct, Liz. I mean, essentially, the court can't order that one party buys the other share of the property. So it is something that can be arranged through negotiation and settlement, if indeed one party is in the position to be able to do that and has the means to buy out the other property. But that's separately to what the court can order. If the agreement can't be made going to court, what would likely happen is that the property would be put on the open market for sale, and that would then give rise to the proposition that either party potentially bid on the property on the open market rather than actually buy the other share off the other. So I think in that situation, if one party was in a position to do so, then really settlement would seem to be the key rather than forcing the issue, because otherwise you go into court, the property would be put on the market and you'd have to bid on it with potentially others.
And that's just more hassle and more legal cost for both parties, really, isn't it?
It could be.
And so, you know, certainly in all our cases, we would try and be quite constructive about negotiating a final settlement, really.
The courts, I think, are very keen on parties trying to reach settlement absent of interference from the court where possible. Not always possible for various reasons, but if it can be, then usually it's to the benefit of both parties, potentially.
No, that's really helpful. Thank you. So hopefully that's provided a little bit of an overview of the differences. And just to sort of summarise, I think certainly from my point of view, doing family work, I would say that it's always helpful if you are thinking of entering into a cohabiting relationship to try and make your intentions quite clear at the outset, just to try and avoid any future difficulties. So one thing we would potentially advise is you could think about a cohabitation agreement. This can be quite a broad agreement, setting out joint intentions, what's intended regarding financial matters, jointly owned property, property that's solely owned. It can cover arrangements for children, because like we said before, just living in a property, making some financial contributions to a mortgage or running a home or bringing up children doesn't mean that legal rights are automatically acquired. You know, in conjunction with a cohabitation agreement, as I think Adam touched on, it's often helpful to think of a declaration of trust with regard to any property, so it's quite clear what each party's respective shares are in the property. And if somebody's already got a property and they've had some investment, they want to ring fence that investment, but potentially the intention is that the parties will benefit from future increases in value. That can all be set out in a declaration of trust. And I think setting out those intentions at the outset can avoid expensive litigation at best, or at worst, possibly a party trying to establish a claim over a property and then being either advised or going to court and finding out that they don't, you know, the claim has no merit, really. The other thing probably to think about is making wills, really. If one partner in an unmarried couple dies, the other one doesn't have an automatic right to inherit a share of a property or possessions without things being specifically spelled out in a will. Possibly that's a subject for a future podcast. But anyway, we've just looked broadly at the differences between the legal position of a married couple and a cohabiting couple. Despite the best efforts of Resolution and their Awareness Week and their campaigning to change rights of cohabiting couples, I think it is still going to be a little bit of time before we see any changes to what the law is. So we would say that if you've got any queries or you'd like any more information about this subject or any related matters, please do not hesitate to contact us, the team at Sintons. Well, that's back to you, David. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thanks to both of you. Enjoyed listening to that one. Very quickly for me, as I say at the end of each of these sessions, we continue to work hard to produce, release and deliver useful and relevant content, articles, podcasts, blogs, all of which can be found on our website, www.sintons.co.uk, should you wish to take a look. And there's a whole wealth of family related content on the website, from the pages themselves, which I've mentioned in previous sessions this week, which are really informative and hopefully insightful. Also, just to remind you of the reason of this podcast, we are supporting Resolution's Awareness Week, which, as the guys have just mentioned there, where they've talked in depth there about cohabitation, is all about highlighting the need for cohabitation reform. And if you haven't heard enough from us by that point, you can also follow us on our social media, which for our family team on Twitter is at Sintons Family, and also on our fairly new Instagram, also at Sintons Family. We've had a lot of engagement with the content that we've put out around Awareness Week this week, so thank you for that. We still have more things to come. Just wanted to thank Adam and Elizabeth for their time, and for Elizabeth appearing on a second session with us, so thank you for that. In terms of their contact details, just finally, if you'd like to discuss anything they've raised today or in anything this week further, please don't hesitate to get in touch. They can both can be contacted via telephone 019-1226-7878 and by their respective email addresses, which is elizabeth.gallagher@sintons.co.uk and adam.hutton@sintons.co.uk. Also, that's all from us. Stay safe, everyone. Thank you once again for listening, and we'll speak to you very soon. Thank you.